Okay, Venerable, we would like to start, if we may.
Yep.
I'll let you get settled. We'd like to start with a mandala to request the teachings.
Good idea. Go for it.
Okay.
Oh, I'm coming in a minute. I can't plug my thing in.
Oh, gosh. Okay, let's go. So okay. What we're going to do, just in case we don't know, who's going to sing? Are you the Om Zay, Donna?
I can, unless you would like to, Venerable.
No, it's auspicious. You should do it because it's the center. Okay. What's happening is the center, Kind Kadampa Center, is offering a mandala, offering a representation, offering the whole universe to the Buddha as a request for the teachings. So it's coming from the center on behalf of everybody. So you should sing it, okay? And so if you don't know the prayer, just imagine all the marvelous things of the world and you pile them all up and you imagine offering them to the Buddha as a request for the teachings. That's the idea. Okay.
Okay. Saji puki chukshin meto drum re rabling shi ni de gen padi sangge jing du me te uai drokunam dakshin ha chu par sho jetsu lama dam pa ke nam ki chu ku kala ken se chu tin trik chi tar cham pe du je jin mala cham ki chu ki char pa wa tu so Iram Guru Ratnamandala Kamniriya Tayami. Oh, Venerable, you're muted.
Muted myself. So there's Linda offering the actual mandala. You can see her. Where is she? With her beautiful mandala. Well done, Linda. Thank you. So now we good start, auspicious start. But now I better sing the refuge prayer, darling, as well. Pop that up.
Okay. Okay.
Now I'll leave that one.
All right.
All you kind people.
I'm a little bit discombobbed. Here we go.
Yeah, okay. Good. All right, so now another little prayer. Thank you so much, Linda. Look at her, offering the body, speech, and mind. How wonderful. Well done. Thank you. Received, Linda. Thank you so much, sweetheart. She's offering the representations of enlightened body, speech, and mind, a text, a statue, and a stupa. Very auspicious. So auspicious to offer all this. Thank you, Linda. There we go. And there's the mind, the stupa. Thank you, Linda. And now I accept. Thank you so much, darling. Thank you. All right. Good. Thank you, Linda, very much. Very auspicious. So now we can sing this next little prayer. And it's got two parts. The first part is those of us who already feel we are Buddhists. It's reminding ourselves of our reliance on the Buddha, the first two lines. And then the second two lines are expressing, the Tibetans would call it setting our motivation. I mean, we probably would say, what's our purpose? What's our goal? Why are we here together? That's what motivation means. So it's the long-term goal, if we can have this one, of having a Buddha so we can be of benefit to all sentient beings. We can think that's our goal. That's why we're sitting here listening to these teachings so we can develop our amazing potential. So no matter how long it takes, we'll eventually become a Buddha, thinking like that. Sangye charang soke chognam la jang chu baru dagni kyap su chi dagi chonyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charang soke chognam la jang chu baru dagni kyap su chi dagi chonyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok Sangye charang soke chognam la chang cho baru dagni kyap su chi dagi chonyen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok. Okay. So this topic, depending on arising, is really the dependent arising is, as Lama Yeshe puts it, Lama Yeshe paraphrasing Tsongkhapa, it's the king of logics to prove emptiness. So, you know, if we look at the packaging of the teachings that we're so familiar with, you know, being a Gelugpa center and Tsongkhapa's teachings, our 14th century lineage Lama, his packaging of this entire kind of body of knowledge is packaged in a way that it's according to the level, it's for the student, for the disciple, for the way you internalize the teachings. So, you know, like we know any body of knowledge, we're very familiar with this in our culture. It's how we learn. You, whether you're studying a 10-year course on cooking or a 1-week course on math, you start with the early stuff, you go to the middle stuff, and you go to the advanced stuff. It's exactly like that here. But I think it takes us time in our culture, the West certainly, to think of learning a spiritual path in those terms, you know. So when we listen to all the teachings, we hear bodhicitta, then we hear emptiness, then we hear karma, then we hear the mind. We hear them all. We give them all kind of equal status in terms of there being Buddha's teachings. But we don't think one you have to practice first, then you practice the next, and then you practice the next. That's kind of surprising to us, you know. But this is the point about the Lam Rim. This packaging of the teachings, it means literally a gradual path. Well, that's a nice medieval phrase for what we would call a course. You're going to do a course, you know, you do something like that. So dependent arising is the king of logics. As I say, I'm quoting Tsongkhapa, is the king of logics to prove emptiness. And we learn this in the packaging of the teachings. We learn that right at the end of the path, at the final stages of the bodhisattva's practice. So what I wanted, we're going to talk about this, but what I wanted to do was present all the stages of the path as starting with karma, then going on to the mind, then going all the way through to emptiness as a preparation for our mind to understand emptiness. So that's very reasonable as well. If you're learning math, you know, you don't just leap into university level math. You start at junior school, you go to high school, and you grow incrementally. You go gradually. So the thing is, all the paths, all the teachings, initially when we hear the Buddhist teachings, we'll hear about emptiness. Oh, that's interesting. Then we'll hear about karma, and that's another thought. Oh, that's interesting. And we don't really see the connection between them. But obviously, if it's a coherent body of knowledge, think about this. If it's a coherent body of knowledge, when you learn 1 + 1 = 2, when you're a little girl, you might not know that it's preparing you for E = mc², but it is. It's obvious. But you don't know that in the beginning. But as you progress, you know, as you progress in your studies, you start to join all the dots, don't you? You start to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. So this is what I wanted to do. How long have we got, Donna? Four classes? Six classes?
Four classes, Venerable.
Four.
Yes.
Four. Okay, good. So what I wanted to do is present each of the points of the Lam Rim and to show how they prepare us to finally get to understanding emptiness, understanding the logic of dependent arising as the king of logics to prove this emptiness. So in other words, another way of putting it is all of Buddha's teachings are presented beautifully to prepare us finally to get the wisdom that can cut the root of all the nonsense, cut suffering completely. And when you conjoin it with bodhicitta, you then become a Buddha. So, okay, so then, you know, as we know very well, if we studied the Lam Rim even a little bit, we know it's presented in kind of three stages, the three levels of teachings. So as we know very well, and quoting Lama Zopa Rinpoche, as he says it very politely, respecting the lineage, he would talk about the very first level of the teachings and practices as those that are suitable for the disciple of the least capability. Is this being recorded? If you're not, I'm going to record. Is it recording?
Yes, it's recording on YouTube.
Okay, good. So usually it says the word recording.
We're not recording in Zoom. We're recording by live streaming it to YouTube. So it's still recording, but it's recording on YouTube instead of recording in Zoom.
Oh, I see. So it's saved there, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So if I needed it, I can look at it there. Or somebody needed it, I can get someone to. Okay, that's good. So now the first... The very first level, as I said, are the teachings and practices. This is quoting Lama Zopa Rinpoche, suitable to the disciple of the least capability. Well, another way we hear it, and Rusev said this is not quite correct, but it's, we all see it in the teachings, it's the teachings that are, it's called the teachings of the lowest scope, the disciple of the lowest scope, the scope, the capacity, you know. Then you've got the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the middle capability, and then you've got the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the greatest capability. That's how they say it. So you know what, I mean, I get very cliched, and I because we use these terms and we understand them, I would say junior school, high school, and university. So I mean, why not, in a sense? It mightn't be literally correct, but in one real sense it is, you know? So that's how I'm going to be referring. So let's start at junior school. Obviously, you don't start in high school, you start in junior school. So what are the teachings? What are the teachings of this lowest capability? So this is also a bit misleading, because it's all the teachings about karma. For example, it starts with the view of karma, and there's some logic to that, which we do need to understand, which doesn't mean that karma is easier to understand than, say, the mind. It's just that for logical reasons in terms of practice, we start with that. It's the very first step a person who wants to follow the Buddhist path would begin at. So we've got to see the logic why. So that what I'm going to talk about is the overt, kind of the obvious, the overt teaching, which is the view of karma, and I'll show the reason why. But I also want to point out why, implicit way, not an explicit way, but implicitly, how understanding karma can help us understand dependent arising, which helps us understand emptiness. In other words, how, by understanding karma, how it prepares us for the more advanced stages. So this very first level of practice, as Lama Zopa says, if you want to start practicing being a Buddhist, the very first thing to start this second is to stop harming others. So we go, well, that's interesting. Why should I do that? And the usual reason we give is because people don't like being harmed. Yes, Buddha agrees, but that's not his reason here at this point. The very first level of practice for the Buddha is recognizing, given that we're suffering, because all of Buddha's path, one way of presenting it, is a set of teachings and practices that enable you to stop suffering, to become happy. That's one way of framing all of the Buddha's path. So the very first level of teachings, then the essence of junior school, there are several practices there, but the essence of it, the culmination of it, and the essence of this level of practice is to learn to abide by the laws of karma. Another way to put it, to live a disciplined life and control your body and speech and stop harming others. Another way to put it, to live in ethics, to live a life of good ethics, to live a life of morality. So then, but now let's look at in the explicit teaching here, which is the Lam Rim. What's the explicit teaching? It is because Buddha's telling us that we're all suffering. If we look at the Four Noble Truths, which we learn more about in high school, he'll say that there is suffering, the first one. Second, there are causes. Third, guess what, folks? You can get rid of both of them, and I've found methods to do that. And fourth is the methods of how to do it, which is very marvelous. So the very first level, the very first cause of suffering, then the Buddha would say, is what he calls karma. So let's look at this. But what I want to really get to is to look at how the implicit teaching of how karma, the law of cause and effect, which is an example, is one of the first examples of this dependent arising, which is the one of the main methods for realizing emptiness. You know, there's a beautiful text, a poetic song of experience written by Tsongkhapa in praise of the Buddha of his teachings on dependent arising, the best way to realize emptiness, which we're going to get into when we get there. But let's look at the explicit teaching of karma first. Why not? So this gets us, so then this is something that really is fundamentally necessary. If we want to understand Buddhism, if we want to understand the entire Buddhist path, the entire Buddhist worldview, you cannot possibly avoid karma. Very often, many people love Buddhism. They do mindfulness, but they have no interest in karma. They think it's some kind of secondary weird thing that somebody's added on. But actually, as we know, if we've listened a little bit, if we understood a little bit about the teachings of where Buddha came from, he came from these amazing Indians more than, as the Dalai Lama always says, it's these amazing Indians more than 3,000 years ago were the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self. I mean, this might surprise us when we think it's Freud or Jung, isn't it? were so arrogant in our culture. But these amazing Indians. So for them, karma was something that they'd observed already. So that's been around for 3,000 years, but not in our culture. It's a brand new concept. Because why? Because it's positing that we have a thing called a consciousness or a mind that is not the handiwork of a creator, is not the brain, therefore is not the handiwork of mummy and daddy, which are the usual views on the planet. In our world, the and certainly in the world of the Arabic, all those religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all share the one view that there is a creator. Might be other religions on the planet as well, but that religious philosophy, which is very prevailing in our culture, is that there is the source of the universe is a creator. It's pretty primordial, but not for the Buddha. He's got this radically different view. And this is the one that's usually a stumbling block for most modern people, for most ex-Christians or Jews or whatever. Unless, of course, you're a Kabbalah Jew. I remember in Florida years ago in Miami, I was part of a conference. And there was me, a rabbi, a Lutheran, and a Catholic. It sounds like a joke, doesn't it? And the topic was, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, you know, the Lutheran and the Catholic, I have to tell you, I did not understand their answers at all. But when I gave my talk before the rabbi, he clapped because I gave a talk about karma. It was easy for a Buddhist, why bad things happen to good people, or indeed why good things happen to bad people. Same logic. So he clapped and he said, we have the same view. He said he was a Kabbalah rabbi, a Kabbalah Jew. And I mean, all the Jews in the audience, I think, were gobsmacked. He cracked jokes about Hitler. I mean, I don't hear Jews crack jokes about Hitler. Well, he did. And he said, we have a saying because they have a view about reincarnation and karma. They don't call it those words, obviously. It's not Sanskrit. But he said, we have a saying that every time something bad happens, we go, great, one less debt to repay. I think the Tibetan Buddhists would love that. So anyway, this view of karma is hugely important. It pervades the whole of the Buddhist worldview. It's not just some interesting extra little bell and whistle added by somebody. It's fundamentally necessary to understand it. Because it's the starting point. It's the starting point for a Buddhist practice, and it pervades your practice from here to Buddhahood. And the view of it is absolutely vital to understand, because it's fundamentally different from the view of having faith in a creator. The concept of faith in Buddhism is very strong. People have faith in the Buddha, but it's very different reason, you know. So then the view of karma, this is the explicit teaching about karma. This is why it's the very first level of practice. The Buddha's deal is this, that this is the law that runs the universe. It's the law that is the natural, it's a natural law. So that word we hear about, we know if we're philosophical materialists, which is the prevailing view in the world these days, we know very well that natural law is what it's all about, and it's contrary to God's law. So that's the usual view we have of religion. It's God's law. There's somebody up high who made the universe, who made the rules, who made the laws, and crucially is a creator, but is a punisher and a rewarder. This view is very powerful in our minds. So as soon as we hear karma, we just hear it in a different way. We just hear it's like a big stick that you use to beat. And it's exactly the same as a creator, but it's totally different. And this is what takes us time to hear in our culture. So the law of karma runs the universe. Nobody runs it. There's no such concept in Buddhism of a creator. There's no such concept of a punisher or rewarder. There is no view. Buddha would argue with that as being a view that exists. He says it exists, that view exists, but one of his crucial philosophical positions, which is utterly related to emptiness, which might not be evident to us initially, is that there cannot be such a thing as a creator, which means, because one of the fundamental qualities of a creator is it doesn't have a source. It doesn't have a cause. And this is a massive point. I mean, I know for the Christians, certainly my Catholic friends, they even, you know, they talk a lot in depth about how there can be a first cause, capital F, capital C. It's a serious philosophy. And this is where Buddha, one of his major reasons, where he diverged from the Hindu position. He got educated in this amazing system by these amazing Indians, you know, more than, you know, would have been around for a good 500 years before him, if not longer. And of course, they also have the view of karma, but they do not have a view of emptiness. And this is the fundamental point. They have other views to some degree, but there's absolutely a view that there's an intrinsic thing called a creator, which has no cause, is permanent, is unchanging. And there's also, therefore, also the philosophy that there is a self or a soul. The Christians call it a soul. The Muslims call it a soul, or we call it a spirit, or the Greeks call it an essence. And there's this view that the essence of this soul has a similar characteristic of God insofar as it's permanent, unchanging, and uncaused. Well, Buddha diverged exactly on those points. He diverged exactly, and that's where his teachings on dependent arising and emptiness come in, you know? That's where he's fundamentally different. So he's not just being argumentative and saying there's no God. Like, you know, in the world, we either have a view there is a God or there's not a God. It's not like that for Buddha. It's a question of a creator. I mean, Buddhism even uses the terms superior being, Arya being. But in the Christian view, superior being equals God. And there's only one of them. And he's the source, and it's usually a he, as we know, is the source of the universe. The view very similar in Hindu religion, even though they have the view of karma and reincarnation. Absolutely the same view, broadly speaking, in Islam and in the Jewish religions as well. That's a view the Buddha says no. He's not argumentative. He just gives his philosophy. And of course, when you study this worldview in depth, you learn that. And the more we understand dependent arising and emptiness, the more it would contradict such a view. So Buddha's not arguing with the concept of superior being. Absolutely. But he would say everybody can become a superior being. Now, that's pretty shocking for a Christian. That sounds like heresy, you know. But the crucial piece that Buddha's arguing with is not the presence of powerful mind, is not the presence of powerful energy that pervades the universe that knows everything, which is what they call God. Buddha would say, call that Buddha, actually. He's not arguing with that. It's the creator component. And anyway, from the Buddhist point of view, not only is there no such thing as a creator, he doesn't argue there's no such thing. There is such a thing as a superior being, but not the creator job. Buddhism doesn't give the job of creating the universe to anybody, because very simply, we don't need creating. Sentient beings do fine. We create our own suffering and our own happiness. Dalai Lama calls karma self-creation, you know? So let's look at this view. This is explicit teaching of karma. But what I'm going to get at and point out so we can discuss is how the implicit teaching here is dependent arising, which is beginning to prepare our mind for understanding emptiness. Already we're starting. Even though, like I said, when you're learning 1 + 1 = 2, you're not thinking that you're getting ready for physics. But here you're getting ready for dependent arising. So, okay, what is this view of karma then? Well, what it depends upon is the existence of a thing called a consciousness or mind. And this is where, again, Buddhism is radically different. If you're a Christian, you talk about you've got a body and a mind, which they call a brain, and we know very well they come from mummy and daddy. But you've got a spirit or a soul, and that comes from God. So if you're a Christian, you track yourself back. At the time of conception, you know, you track yourself back to God. If you're a materialist, philosophical materialist, you track yourself back to mummy, daddy, grandma, grandpa, and the monkeys. That's how, because it's all physical, isn't it? Well, Buddha's got a third way of seeing it. He says, we've got a body and we have a mind. Now, the word mind is used synonymously with the word consciousness. Second, it is not physical. It is not the brain. Now, I mean, I'm not trying to insult neuroscientists, but I think a very excellent way of putting what a mind is or what the brain is a physical indicator of what is going on in the mind or the consciousness. And that's not trying to insult neuroscientists. It's a perfect way of putting it. That's exactly the right way of putting it from the Buddhist perspective. We've got a consciousness which is not physical. And it takes time to get used to this idea if we're brought up with a materialist philosophical view. It's shocking to hear it. Because when we say mind, we equate it with the brain, not for the Buddha. He's not arguing we have a brain. Clearly we've got a brain. But that's not Buddha's expertise. He's not discussing the brain. When you study Buddhist psychology, you're not discussing the brain. You're discussing the states of mind that we figure are the brain, but which are not physical for the Buddha. Love, compassion, kindness, hate, jealousy, nothing special, these words. We can find indications of them in the brain, like I said, but they're not themselves the brain. That's the way to put it. Now, this consciousness of ours, within which this law of karma runs, the law of karma runs the minds and lives of beings, or if you like, the minds and lives of beings run within the law of karma. The law of karma is not run by anybody. It wasn't invented by anybody. And it's natural law insofar as botany is natural law. Now, we know perfectly well, or numbers, let's say math is natural law. So we have to think about this, because this is the point. This is so crucial to understand. that when we say God's law, we mean the being who created a law. And then he is the boss and he runs it. And then he punishes and rewards. I mean, that's a fairly simplistic view of a creator, isn't it? You know, if maybe more advanced mystical views won't talk about it like that so much, but fundamentally, God is the source. There's no view like that. We don't need a first cause. And in fact, we can't have such a thing as a first cause. It's a contradiction in terms, as far as the Buddha is concerned. Because if you posit cause and effect, then by definition, you cannot go back to a thing which we all desperately want to do. Where did it all begin? Where did the happiness begin? Where did it begin? Where did I begin? We all instinctively want a first cause. And why, by the way, is because we have this view called ego grasping. We're going to go into this, that believes there is an intrinsic this, intrinsic that, that has a first cause. We believe that totally, and we desperately want one of those, and it blows our mind to think you can't find such a thing. You can't find such a thing, not because it exists and you can't find it, because it simply doesn't exist. So it really takes a time for us, our mind, to get our head around this concept. And it sounds nutty, because the implication of this is, if your consciousness, your mind, your river of mental moments, if you keep tracking back, and you could, there's a really good meditation to do that, you track back this moment to the previous moment of consciousness, to the previous moment of consciousness, to the previous moment of consciousness. You know very well you would track yourself back in an unbroken chain of mental moments right back to the second that you started in your mother's little fallopian tube, where it joined, you know, where your consciousness came from before and joined the egg and sperm there. So then you go back to a second before conception. If you're a materialist, you go back, you know, eggs in mummy's body and sperm is in daddy's body, and you track those back to the monkeys or whatever. And if you're a Christian, you track yourself back to God, the soul. Neither of those for the Buddha. Your egg and sperm go back to mummy and daddy, no problem. They do give you a brain. They do give you the DNA and the genes and the this and the that and the blonde hair or the you know, the whatever it is that you've got. They, for sure, that comes from the mummy and daddy. But your mind, your love, your intelligence, your psychosis, your generosity, your forgiveness, they do not come from mother and father. They do not come from a creator. So this is quite shocking to hear, because we so take it as a given that they do. So to get used to this idea, in fact, for the Buddha, the more you use, the more you work with the Buddha's ideas, the more weird it is that someone can give you anger, give you psychosis, give you love. It's a very odd idea in Buddhism. The mind is incredibly subjective and personal. And so the key point, and this is the essence of the karmic view, that whatever is in your mind this second, whatever you do and say this second, what are the main causes of those? Is the tendency of having thought and done and said those before. And those tendencies are in your mind. So then you ask the question, well, where did those tendencies come from? Well, guess what, honey? From the previous tendencies. And well, where did they come from? Well, you get right back to the first second of conception, and your consciousness came from before, imprinted with those tendencies from having done them before. So you keep thinking, but where's the first one? Well, you won't find one. So conclusion is, your mind, your consciousness, and the contents of it, love and compassion and kindness and anger and jealousy, are beginning less. I mean, this is mind-boggling for us. It's just like too absurd for words, you know. But this is the only conclusion, if you posit cause and effect. But not only that, in the Vajrayana model of the Buddhist teachings, the more esoteric Buddhist teachings, they talk about the components, the components of the universe are precisely two. Well, broadly, there's minds, billions upon billions upon billions of consciousnesses, mind streams, and then matter. And matter, still, for this view, it used to be this way in our, you know, culture, back in the time of Mr. Galileo, they talked about the four elements. Well, they still talk about the four elements. This is still a workable model, certainly in the Vajrayana. So the physical world is made of the four elements. So the four elements also are beginningless. So, you know, as His Holiness said in one of his many, many marvelous conversations over these last 30, 40 years with all the best brains in the West, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, he said, Big Bang, no problem. Just not the first Big Bang, that's all. Because we're all desperately wanting the first Big Bang, you know, like the first everything. And this is a fundamental, it's a fundamental misconception in the first place. So we've got to get used to the same thinking it's the wrong question, you know. But it's not the wrong question to ask what are the causes of suffering and happiness. But we want a big bang cause, we want a big capital F cause, you know, first cause. Not like that. It's a more evolutionary process. And that's the process of karma. So the law of karma means the law of, in this is specifically the law of cause and effect, which of course we very well familiar with. That's the world. Science is the law of, brilliant. Botanists understand very well the law of cause and effect of gardens. You know, anybody who's a decent scientist, a decent musician, a decent whatever, they know the laws of cause and effect of that area. Buddha's expertise is happiness and suffering. One way of framing all the Buddha's teachings is in terms of how to get happy and how to stop suffering. Another way of presenting all of Buddhism, which is the approach we're taking here, is, or both, is it's a method for how to stop ignorance and how to get wisdom. We mightn't think we want wisdom. It sounds a bit abstract, but the Buddhist approach is very fascinating. The degree to which we suffer for the Buddha is the degree to which we are not in touch with wisdom, not in touch with how things exist. And the degree to which we are therefore happy is the degree to which we have wisdom. So these two really go hand in hand together. In fact, the method, which is how we're talking about emptiness here, the method for getting happy is to get wisdom. Because why? Because we suffer because our minds are living in la-la land. So but we don't discuss that yet because that's in high school. We get into the mind in high school. First, we have to learn to subdue. This is the explicit teaching of karma in junior school, in the first scope. We have to harness the energy. We have to control the servants of the mind. And what are they? The body and the speech. So because in our culture, we're so totally caught up in believing that this big bag of bones is me. We know we've got body, we know we have speech, and we know we have mind. We don't distinguish. We just think this is a big lump of me plodding through the world, you know? So this is a really kind of insightful way of putting, an insightful way of presenting your levels of practice. So the Buddha's deal is, given that we're driven by a bunch of neurotic states of mind, which we learn really about in high school, not junior school. We're driven by those, and they are why we suffer. So it's too much to expect us to start to observe the mind, which is really quite subtle. So the Buddha's deal is, first, entry level, junior school, grade one, control the body and control the speech and stop doing actions driven by these neurotic states of mind, which happen to be actions that harm others, which in turn, and this is the crucial point, are the actions that will cause me suffering. So the Buddha's essential point with karma is that every millisecond of what we think and do and say, every millisecond of what we think and do and say, none of it goes astray. All of this, starting with the mind, sows seeds in our mind, in our mind stream, programs our mind, sows seeds in our mind, and seeds being the way they are will ripen eventually in that mind as our future experiences, very simply, either as happy experiences or as suffering experiences. There are a category called indifferent experiences, neutral. Don't worry about them. So it's not a complicated concept, but it's just so shocking because Buddha puts us absolutely center, in the center of responsibility for happiness and suffering. That Buddha's main point, and this is in the Four Noble Truths, and the first noble truth is, hey, folks, there is suffering. And Buddha presents three levels of suffering. And each of these different levels of practice are approaches to the cessation of those levels of suffering. So the very first level of suffering is the one we all understand. It's the suffering of pain. It's when the bad things happen. So let's just look at that one without even worrying about the more subtle ones we'll get to when we get to high school. And even more subtly, when we get to emptiness, we're going to look at these subtler levels of suffering. But this very first level is when the bad things happen. So let's look at these words, happiness and suffering. These are really powerfully important to understand. These are massively important to understand, actually, to get the Buddha's view. So because now the general view we have, which Buddha calls the samsaric view, that we are totally addicted to from having practiced this view for many, many lifetimes, Buddha says, the view we all have, the samsaric view, the instinctive view of ego, is that we're this innocent victim who somehow got plonked on this planet by somebody else. And as we know, it's either mummy, daddy, or God, with respect, or mummy and daddy together, and then God. But usually it's mummy, isn't it? Mummy's the main. Nobody blames daddy. Mummy gets all the blame. We know that. So it's either mummy and daddy together who caused me, who made me, who gave me anger and jealousy and resentment. And so, and then, you know, and or it's God. Of course, we don't want to blame God. We can't do that unless you're Italian. I always quote this, and the Italians get upset sometimes. But one Argentinian told me that the Argentinians abused God even more than the Italians. I remember Lama Yeshe, when he was in Italy, visiting Geshe Jama Gyatso, one of his good friends who taught for many years our master's program in the Italian center near Pisa. Lama was in the hospital with Geshe-la, and the Italian boys were all translating what the men in the ward were saying about God. Because God's a pig. I mean, God is a pig. Even worse, Our Lady's a whore. I mean, I've even heard worse things about Our Lady. I mean, I was a Catholic. I was an Irish Catholic in Australia. You never said one bad word about God. I mean, that was just too shocking for words. I don't know who else does, but the Italians and the Argentinians, they're the ones I know so far. Anyway, whatever. But we know we sort of can't blame God. You don't like to blame God. So we don't know where to turn. We don't know where to turn, you know? This view of being an innocent victim, Lama Yeshe calls this is ego, the irony of ego in Buddhism. It sounds very cruel, but Lama Yeshe would say it's the self-pity me. And it's very deeply the view, and this is the point now about emptiness, that's absolutely diametrically opposite the view that is reality. The Buddha says the actual reality, and this is emptiness now, going to the higher scope, emptiness is referring to this reality that nothing, the I and everything else, nothing has an intrinsic nature. Nothing is existing in and of itself. Nothing exists independently. Nothing exists inherently. So we hear that and we get puzzled. And we think, well, why is Buddha telling us that? Why he's telling us that things don't have an inherent nature is, guess what, folks? Because we think they do. And that's the surprise to us. Whoever thought that they thought that their I existed intrinsically? I mean, what a joke, you know? And all this is showing us is this mistake that Buddha has observed in his own mind, the mistake of the deepest of these neurotic states of mind, which we're going to get into in high school, maybe before, the deepest mistake, the most primordial mistake, deep in the bones of our being, so primordial, so ancient for countless lifetimes, it's absolutely at the level of total assumption. There's no articulate thought that says, oh, I'm inherent. No way. So therefore, we've never heard of such a thing. We've never heard of such. This is Buddha's unique view. Even these amazing Indians before him, they went so far in eradicating suffering and its causes, but they did not get far enough. This is what they say, you know. That's where Buddha diverged in his own direction. This incredible view, unbelievable view, they say. This is what Tsongkhapa praising Buddha for his incredible findings. How that that nothing in the universe, whatever exists, whatever is posited as existing, necessarily cannot have an independent nature, an inherent nature, an intrinsic nature. So, of course, it's puzzling to us because we've never heard of such a concept. But why Buddha is telling us is so simple is because he says, you know what, folks, that's the mistake you are making. And, of course, it's the hardest mistake to see. So we can't just leap to discover that mistake. We've got to go through these stages of abiding by the laws of karma, understanding some accountability from that, going to high school, understanding the mind, the way it functions, preparing ourselves for this, even then going to the compassion wing and practicing compassion. All of this is preparing our mind to then easily be able to unpack and unravel these misconceptions, you know. So we go one step at a time, and everything is leading us to that unpacking of that primordial misconception. So the view of karma, then, from this perspective, is a marvelous example of the first level of dependent arising. The Buddha, there's hundreds of ways in which things exist interdependently. As a noun, they exist as a dependent arising. It's a quaint phrase. Everything exists interdependently. In one sense, it's fairly evident, you know. Long only exists in reference to short. Up only exists in reference to down, etc., etc. There are many ways in which things exist interdependently. So the Buddha, though, when we're going to look into emptiness, and we get there, and we're going to be there, we're going to be coming and going, You know, he presents three levels at which things exist interdependently as marvelous logical arguments to break down this deep intrinsic misconception of ego grasping, this mistake that the mind makes. So the first level at which things exist interdependently, and Buddha here is taking these three levels as arguments with the views that prevailed before him, the Indian views. And there are many variations of these, but these are the three essential arguments he has with those views before. And the very first one, the grossest view, is that things, that this view that he's arguing with, is that there is a self that is not caused, that is permanent, unchanging, and uncaused. So, and this is the same concept of a creator. It's got the same characteristics. Buddha's arguing clearly that such a thing cannot exist. He's just being clever. He's saying such a thing cannot exist. Everything in the universe that exists as an all impermanent phenomena, minds and matter, are necessarily impermanent. They necessarily have the characteristic of being the product of causes. Whatever is a product of a cause is impermanent. Whatever is impermanent changes from moment to moment. This is the nature and these extensive teachings of the Buddha about impermanence, you know. So this first example, the first practice, abide by the laws of karma, as I've been saying, the explicit teachings is nothing to do with about emptiness yet. But as you learn to understand karma, as you learn to understand that you are the cause of your happiness and your suffering, not someone out there. You're not this innocent victim that got plonked on this planet. You're not just this poor self-pity me to whom bad things and good things happen without understanding why, with no cause, which is how we feel. So by understanding the law of karma, that every millisecond of whatever I experience, we can track back its cause in my mind from my past actions. Even as 50,000 lives ago, there's not a millisecond of anything I can ever experience that isn't from a cause that I did in my mind that goes back, you know, countless lifetimes. This is a fundamental law. Buddha did not make this up. It's not punishment. It's not reward. So we have to learn it, obviously. It's a powerful view. So utterly different from both the materialist view and from the Christian teaching, for example. Fundamentally different in many ways. Primordially different. There's not a millisecond of whatever I think and do and say that isn't the fruit of seeds that I have planted in my continuity of consciousness. It would be an impossibility to have any experience of any kind if I hadn't sown the seed. So in other words, you cannot possibly find in your garden any weed or herb that didn't have a seed. That's contradictory. We know that. By definition, whatever's in your garden is from a seed that was in your garden. And this is the point about karma. It's a really nice example. Buddha talks about seeds and fruits. That if a seed is in the ground in your garden, then obviously it will bring a fruit. So whose is that fruit? Who planted it? You don't say, who put a weed in my garden? You know, by definition, because it's your garden, you must put the seed there or you must not have pulled it out. But it's your garden by definition. So the fruit of it is yours. This is a really good analogy for life, you know. Like our life is like our garden. Put it that way. Whatever we meet, whether it's winning $1 million in the lottery, having your leg cut off, having someone hate you, love you, whatever it might be, every millisecond of your life, you can track each millisecond as being an experience, either a happy one or a suffering one. And each one of those is the fruit of a seed that you planted in your mind in the past. I mean, the concept is not complicated. It's not complicated. It's just that it's so shocking. We're just not used to it. Even if we're good little Buddhists, we don't often unpack it really strongly and really analyze, you know, and really look into it carefully. We have, because ego grasping, this colloquial term that's used for this root delusion, the root misconception in the mind, called simply ignorance, but known colloquially when we talk about it in relation to how it clings to the self, the I, This mistake is so primordial that it causes us to feel like this innocent victim. It causes us to feel that everything happens out there unfairly. Now, of course, if good things happen, even if they're unfair, we don't care. Just give me more, please. But if bad things happen, oh my goodness, look at us. Look at the, and this is what's fascinating. This is why we suffer so badly. We think we suffer because the boyfriend was mean to us. No. We suffer mainly because of all these primordial misconceptions deep in the bones of our being that are completely not in sync with reality. We suffer because we have no view of karma. We suffer because we have primordial attachment. And we're going to discuss this in great detail. This is especially a high school topic. Attachment is the main effectory, the main cause of suffering in daily life, according to the Buddha. And attachment is this bottomless pit of emotional hunger that is an assumption also, assumption that I must get what I want every millisecond. This is the deepest assumption in all of us. And so deep an assumption, like I said, we basically take it as a given. So we assume it is natural to only want happiness. And therefore we assume that someone had better make me happy. So we assume it's the boyfriend's job to only be nice to me. We assume that. There's no logic to this. There's no logic whatsoever. We assume it's my human right to have people only be kind to me. And we cannot think of any reason other than that. Well, that's not a reason. It's because you want it badly doesn't mean that's a logical reason. You can want roses in your garden till the cows come home. Just because you think you deserve I deserve roses. Well, you better start planting them, baby. That's what Buddha's saying. But we think they've got to come from somewhere else. We think the weeds come from somewhere else. Who put weeds in my garden? Why aren't there roses in my garden? That's the view of life we have. The hubris of it is really pretty intense. It's quite shocking to talk this way, but this is really the way of talking of the Buddhist view, you know. We have this deep attachment and deep aversion. Attachment and anger, we run between these two 1,000 times a day. And they're at the level of deep assumption. And these are why we suffer. It's hard to see this. It's really hard to see this. So, okay, in the Second Noble Truth, Buddha articulates the causes of suffering. And he pins it down to precisely two. One is called karma, which means an action that I did in the past, 37 lives ago, whatever it might be, that driven by number two, a delusion. So karma and delusions. It's a very simple answer. It's so simple we can't hear it because we think it's so complicated. Why is there suffering in the world? Nobody knows. We write all these history books. We don't know why there's suffering. This is Buddha's analysis. And initially, it almost seems too simple. We can't believe it. Buddha articulates two main causes. And they're both inside me. One is called the past action that I did. And then on the basis of that, driven by the delusion, anger, attachment or whatever, that drove me to do that action. They are the two main causes of any moment of any suffering I have ever had, having now or will ever have. That's Buddha's analysis. It's like absurdly simple. And that's why it's so hard for us to hear, because we just think it's too absurd, you know, too simple, too ridiculous. Or we hear it as religion, so we put it in the sky, you know. And where does this information come from? His experience. I remember, always quote this, I love this. Years and years ago, in Nelson in New Zealand, I remember, one fellow in the audience asked the question, and he happened to be a scientist. And he said, who revealed the teachings to the Buddha? And I've never had a person ask me that before or since. And it's a great question. It's brilliant. Because why? Because that's the assumption we have about religion, isn't it? This revelation. It's from on high. It's from a superior being who created it. And then God reveals it to somebody. That's how we think of religious philosophy. It comes necessarily from on high. We would never think it comes from an ordinary human being. That makes it ordinary and that we can't think it's possible, you see. So it was an amazing question. And I said to him, well, I said, nobody. Would you ask Einstein who revealed the teachings about relativity to him? And of course, he laughed and so did everybody else, because that sounds like a joke. But that's literally the Buddhist answer. Everything that is called Buddhism, if it's valid, and there's a lot of rubbish published, I promise you, If it's valid Buddhism, it has come directly from the experience of a person who has experienced it. So is that not normal? Is that not usual knowledge? We know that. If you get a cookbook, you know perfectly well if Mary Smith wrote that cookbook, you can either deduce that Mary Smith herself has had the experience of those recipes and that she's now sharing her recipes, or she had got them from her mummy or somebody and she would politely credit mummy or somebody in the introduction. Otherwise, she's stealing, isn't she? We know that. We know they didn't come from on high. We know they came from her direct experiential knowledge. Well, that's the Buddha's view. There's not a single tiny view in the entirety of the Buddha's path from here to enlightenment that hasn't come from the direct experience of, in this case, it would be a person who's achieved Buddhahood. Because the Buddha says everybody can become a Buddha. It's not like the Christian teaching, you know, where only God is existing and God is God and you can become like God, you can become close to God, but you cannot become God. And to say that you can prove what God says implies that you become God. So that's an impossibility. But that's exactly what Buddha is saying. And in fact, as the Dalai Lama tells us, modern people, If you decide to, this is my words partly, if you decide to follow Buddha's methodology and at some point practicing it sincerely, ticking the boxes as you go, you can prove from your direct experience that actually he is mistaken. Then, of course, you must reject the Buddha. That's exactly what Buddha did with the Hindus. He went as far as he could go. He ticked the boxes as he went, proved each point, and then he got further, and then he realized they hadn't proved that one, so then he diverged. And that's the teachings on emptiness, you know. That's the major difference. So I've said a few things in the hour I'm here. I'm almost at hour, Donna. So now would you like me to ask you some questions about anything I've talked about? We've got to go into more detail, but I'm trying to get the overview done here, you know, the overview. So do you have any questions? Anybody, any kind of question? We're going to unpack it all as we go in these next 3 weeks, you know. Any questions, you dearest people? If not, it's perfectly fine. Anyone in the chat box, Donna?
Nothing in the chat box right now.
Okay. Anybody? Hello, all you kind people. Look, there's Elise. Hello, you darling Elise. How are you, sweetheart? So good to see you. And all everybody, there's Tipton. You're still in Nepal, Venerable Nun?
No, Venerable, I'm here in Raleigh.
Oh, well done. Good on you. Where are you staying?
With Elise.
Oh, well done. Good on you. I'm very pleased. Is it good to be back in the States?
It's lovely to reconnect with Geshe Gelick and Geshe Sunpo and all the Kadampa Center family. Yeah.
Wonderful. I'm very pleased. Yeah. Good. Okay. Go on, you people. Questions? Anybody? A question? A question? Any old question? I don't mind. I mean, I'm happy to keep talking, but just in case. No. Okay. So, okay. The explicit, let me just say it again. The explicit teaching in junior school, entry level, grade one, the essence of the junior school, the essence of the first scope, you start to practice when you start to stop killing, stop stealing, and stop jumping on the wrong partner. Three actions of the body. And what are those actions by definition? They are actions of our body driven, obviously, by attachment or anger. Two of the three poisons. Buddha's got this amazing view of the mind, thousands of states of mind, but he divides them all into three categories. The first lot are the negative, neurotic, ridiculous ones, all driven by ego, driven by fear. And he narrows all, they're all subsumed to three, the so-called three poisons. And they sound so cute to us, so initially so simple, but they're profound. Attachment and anger in daily life, and they're driven by the root delusion, ego grasping, ignorance. So actions driven by them, they are what are labeled a negative action. So because everything you do and say and think, see, it sows a seed in your mind that will ripen as your future suffering or happiness. And because you do not want suffering, so then Buddha's first level of instructions will stop causing it, sweetheart. It's like you go to the doctor and she says you've got diabetes. And her first instruction isn't to go off and stop eating. Her first instruction is not to go and start eating good food. It's to stop eating the bad food. You stop doing the causes of diabetes. That's your first instruction. Stop eating those cakes, Robina. And the same with the Buddha. You want future suffering, honey? You want to be killed, lied, stolen from? No. Well, then stop causing it. And that, of course, is the hard part, because we can't even get our head around the idea that our mind has had a past life and a future life. But that's the hypothesis here. This is Buddha's fundamental view. This is just the natural law of the universe, that minds are beginningless and endless and take lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes until we do the job of cutting the root by realizing emptiness and getting the hell out of samsara, you know. So the first step is stop causing future suffering. And this, I think, for us takes a while, because we think, oh, you mean I should stop harming others because it harms me? Oh, that sounds selfish, we will say. But we don't get it if we say that. We've got to understand. You don't go to the doctor and she says, you know, you're getting diabetes and you think you've got to give diabetes, you've got to give sugar up because you don't want to harm other people. It's too advanced. You've got to first not want suffering yourself. You've got to want to be absolutely do not want for future suffering. And that's what's hard for us, because we have no concept of future lives, and we have even less concept that we create our own experiences. This is what's hard for us to get, you know. Because we're convinced it's all out there. So the next four things Buddha exhorts us not to do are four actions of the speech. So this is us humans, you know. We mightn't go around raping and killing too many people, but we absolutely are very good at speech. So he exhorts us to not say words that aren't true. He exhorts us to not use harsh language, abuse people. He gets us to not say bad things about people behind their backs, create terrible disharmony, and he encourages us not just to rabbit on about nothing. Four actions of speech, because the point is, and this is so hard to hear, every millisecond of what we think and do and say, every millisecond of what we think and do and say, none of it goes astray. Every second of it is like you've got a handful of seeds and you're standing in a garden and all day you're dropping seeds. So if you knew that every second you thought and did and said something, you were sowing seeds in the ground, you'd be very damn careful about the quality of those seeds, wouldn't you? But we don't have that view, because we've got this intense kind of assumption of a concrete, self-existent lump of innocent victim me plodding through life. And I'm allowed to think this, and I'm allowed to say that. We think like this. We have no sense of accountability. We have no sense of cause and effect, no sense of that we are producing ourselves second by second by second. I think this is so interesting, because when it comes to, say, let's say a skill, for example, playing the piano, we know perfectly well that everything you think and do and say in relation to music is what produces the musician. I mean, it's schizophrenic to think, oh, I can play what I like and I can still become like Bach. I'm sorry, you won't. You've become an idiot on the piano. Everything you think and do and say in relation to music is precisely what produces the musician. But when it comes to math, cooking, we get it beautifully. But when it comes to happiness and suffering, we have the weirdest, wackiest ideas on the planet. We don't think that we play any role at all, because we think it's the boyfriend who should make me happy. It's sort of like thinking you go to learn piano and you sit there like a big lump of nothing waiting for the teacher to turn you into a musician. Well, it's your responsibility. Make me a musician. You don't think you're supposed to do anything. That's how idiotic we are when it comes to happiness and suffering. We're like this utterly passive, hopeless, self-loathing, pathetic, sad person who thinks other people should make me happy. And then how dare they make me suffer? We don't think that what we think has any role at all. I mean, that's called schizophrenic. I'm sorry. But that's how we believe. That's the view of ego. It's so demented. Lama Zopa says, and it's very shocking to hear this, he says that the vast majority of humans on the planet have absolutely no idea, and these are his words, okay? They have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind plays any role at all in their lives. Please hear those words. This is almost too hard to believe that's true. What he means is, and you see the proof of it, we say, I'm allowed to think what I like. We say it like that. What do we mean by that? That's like saying, I'm allowed to eat sugar whenever I want to. But of course we are. But what we don't realize is that that sugar will bring consequences. And that's the point that's missing with our minds. We don't think that what we think plays any role in our lives. We don't think that what we think, not to mention do and say, plays any role in our happiness and suffering. I mean, you've got to analyze that. It's really quite shocking. But that's the view in our world. It's completely bizarre. So the Buddha's view is so utterly opposite. It's an incredible view, and this is karma, and this is dependent arising, and this is helping us loosen the grip of ego grasping, that everything we think and do and say is what produces the person I become. There is nothing else. Of course, it's the outside world, the conditions. But it's what you think and you say and you do, that is exactly what produces a musician, and that is what produces a happy person or a suffering person. So we are the boss. We are the creator of ourselves. It's not something cosmic, but it's really hard to see it because we've got the exact opposite view of this innocent victim who didn't ask to get born and who is the innocent victim of somebody else's plan out there of happiness and suffering, you know. And I deserve happiness and I don't deserve suffering. I mean, we could speak about that for a month. These are the assumptions that our delusions tell us and we believe them. And the Buddha says, these are why we suffer. Very powerful, you know. So the explicit reason Buddha exhorts us not to kill and steal and lie is so you can stop sowing seeds in your mind that will ripen as your future suffering. It's pretty logical. Don't eat sugar, honey. You won't get diabetes. It's pretty logical. Thank you, doctor. How intelligent. Instead of thinking I'm allowed to eat whatever sugar I like. Well, you are allowed, but there are going to be consequences, honey. To whom? To you. Very simple. But you see, we also have this schizophrenic view. Don't think be insulted if I use that term like that. Let me guess you would use it often. Utterly disconnected from reality. You are one thing and something else is something else. It's the demented, you know. We actually feel, this comes from ego grasping, the deep delusion. Because we're so addicted to blame and punishment and reward, we feel if nobody sees us do it, oh, I got away with it, we'll say. Now, that's like thinking when you go home and your doctor's not there and you go, oh, she's not here. She won't see me. So I'll eat sugar. So, of course, I won't get diabetes because we assume that diabetes is punishment, you see. We assume this view of what we think is punishment. So if someone doesn't see you kill, you got away with it. If someone doesn't see you lie, you got away with it. That is completely schizophrenic. That's like thinking that you won't get diabetes because your doctor doesn't see you. That's like thinking that when your teacher's not there, you can play the piano any way you like and it won't make a difference. I mean, it's just demented. It's completely irrational. But that's how we are. And grown-up people, intelligent people think this because this is the view of ego grasping. This is the view of no cause and effect. This is the view of the self-pity me, you know, and we all have it. Whether the most brilliant mathematician in the universe. And this is what I find very fascinating, actually, about what we mean by wisdom. Buddha's view of wisdom is utterly related to ethics. You can't separate them. So we know in our world, you can have the most intelligent person in the universe who's the best physicist in the planet. But we know perfectly well that genius person, that best physicist, can still go home and beat up her husband and children because she's neurotic. And we don't find that a contradiction. That's not a possibility in the Buddhist view of understanding having wisdom. If you've got wisdom, it means you see things interdependently. You've got a view of reality, which means you're less neurotic, you're less attached, you're less angry, you're less deluded, because they are what blind you from reality. So by becoming wise, you become moral, and therefore you become happy. These three come together. That's why our wisdom in our culture is up in the head. It's demented, you know. It's got zero to do with ethics. That's very suffering. That's very sad. And this is not just some vague theory. The logic of ethics in Buddhism and the logic of wisdom utterly fit together. Because wisdom is what you get when you lessen the views of ego. This is where, right here, where you first start controlling your body and speech. And now when we get to high school, now that we've subdued the body and speech to some degree, we can now work on the mind. We can now work on the, and this is where the next level of practice, the high school level, the middle scope, where the essence of this one is understanding the mind, becoming your own therapist, as Lama Yeshe beautifully puts it, which means we learn the Buddhist model of the mind. We learn Lowry. We learn the way Buddha breaks down the contents of our mind. We learn the epistemological model of the mind. We learn the psychological model of the mind. And Buddha's view is so fascinating. It's brilliant, I tell you. And especially the psychological model, where we learn the contents of our mind, all these thousands of states of mind that we all have, that we believe come from mummy and daddy and grandpa or whoever. And we believe that, you know, that they're a function of the brain. They're not. And these states of mind, the Buddha says, which are our tendencies, he divides them into three categories precisely. There's no fourth category of all the thousands of states of mind. This seeming chaos in here. We've got the ability, Buddha says, to completely sort out this chaos. This is what's so brilliant. This is Buddha's unique approach. You know, based on getting single-pointed concentration, shamatha, we can get this laser-like focus by studying Lowrig, by studying the Buddhist view of the mind. We can learn to distinguish the neuroses from the virtues. There are three essential categories: those that are neurotic, deluded, ridiculous, non-virtuous, ego-based, I-based, and fear-based, that cause suffering and cause us to live in la-la land. Join the universe, folks. Then there are those that are reasonable, valid, love, compassion, intelligence, kindness, wisdom, that are reasonable, that are in sync with reality to some degree, and are the source of our happiness. And the third category, they call them neutral, but that misleads us, and I like to call them the mechanics of our mind. Concentration, good memory, intention, attention. There are many of these. And these, whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need them. So they're neither virtuous nor non-virtuous in their character. And these are very, very specific labels that Buddha uses for these categories of states of mind. And we need to comprehend them if we want to be Buddhist. If we don't get this, we can't say we're Buddhist. So this is where we start to be a Buddhist. Learn to be our own therapists. If the implicit teaching of karma that helps us understand dependent arising is understanding cause and effect, which is an example of the first level of dependent arising. And I mean to say karma a bit more. And from that, how do you become? How do you become if you start to apply the laws of karma? I'll go to the mind in a second. How you become when you really start to use the laws of karma as the basis of your life, how you come when you start is you become more accountable. You become less the victim, less self-pity me, less blame, less reward, less guilt, less neurotic, more content, more fulfilled, therefore less ego grasping. It steadies your mind. That's just karma. Now we get to understand the mind itself. So here, the explicit teaching here in the middle scope is we learn the contents of the mind. We learn all the definitions of attachment and aversion and this and jealousy and love and compassion, how this is this and this is that. It all sounds very technical, which it is. We learn the definitions of these different states of mind, these different mental states. So how this helps us get to understand emptiness, the implicit teaching here, and this is really profound. This is getting us closer to understanding dependent arising. And therefore emptiness. You see, this the two main, Buddha makes this utter distinction between the neurotic, between neurotic states of mind and virtuous states of mind. And again, of course, this is not how we talk in modern psychology. We never talk about virtue and non-virtue. That sounds too heavy. We don't like that. We don't talk about negative or positive states of mind. That's too judgmental. We don't like that in modern psychology. But this is absolutely the distinction that Buddha makes between the states of mind that cause us suffering and causes to harm others, and they're called attachment, anger, jealousy, depression, anxiety, all rooted in ego grasping, the root delusion. It's fairly evident. You don't kill people out of love. You don't steal money out of generosity. It's obvious the neurotic states of mind drive our crazy actions. It's so much a given, we almost don't even notice it. So then the virtuous states of mind, because they're more rooted in independent arising, we need to look into this. It's not evident to us. They're the source of our happiness. So by learning about the mind, we learn the two distinctive qualities, characteristics that the negative ones have. One is, and this is the key one, this is the explicit teaching here in the middle scope, the explicit teaching is that the delusions are, one of the synonyms is disturbing emotion. Well, check the last time you're anxious, depressed, angry, jealous. Of course you were disturbed. That's absolutely evident. And that's the main emphasis in the middle spoke. We learn to see how painful attachment and anger and jealousy are. And this is nothing moralistic. This is just showing how they cause me to break my heart. They're deeply disturbing to me, not to worry about other people. This is the main energy we get in the middle scope, to want to give up these awful states of mind. But what's the subtler one? The implicit teaching, which prepares us to understand the way the root delusion functions when we learn about emptiness, is the second characteristic of these states of mind, which is called delusional. In the English language, this is a really great word. I've noticed when I get translated into Spanish or Italian or French or whatever, Hebrew, there's no equivalent of this word delusion. It's very arcane and strange. So they're very weird terms in the other languages. But in English, it's brilliant. You know perfectly well, if somebody accuses you of being delusional, you know what they mean is that you're not in touch with reality. Listen to it. It's brilliant. Well, this is the bullseye for what Buddha's saying is the actual function of the neurotic states of mind. The actual function of attachment, anger, ego grasping, and all the other thousands of neurotic states of mind, of the disturbing emotions, or the term they use a lot in Buddhist psychology, afflictions. I find that very arcane. I never use it, although it's the common one all the lamas use. Delusion tells us very powerfully that these states of mind, to the degree that they prevail in your mind, is the degree to which you are not in sync with reality. When we can understand this, I tell you, we are absolutely on track in understanding Buddha's very specific view about why we suffer and why we do actions that are mistaken, why we harm others, and therefore why we don't ever understand reality. And this prepares us to understand the root delusion, the root misconception, the root lie. So how do these unhappy states of mind cause us to be delusional? How they cause us to suffer. Okay, it's very clear. It's very obvious. If I'm attached, okay, of these all these thousands of negative states of mind, we know they all subsume to these three. And it almost sounds too simplistic for us, the three poisons. I mean, it sounds so cute, doesn't it? You don't go to your therapist, oh, I've got the three poisons. So it's like you just shut up and go home, you know, until you want to kill your husband. But this is the point. I mean, they're so cute, these words, three toxic emotions. There's one, which is the root delusion, the one that such that when you realize emptiness, you've uprooted it, which means you're out of samsara. You've got more work to do. You've got way to go. That's called simply called ignorance, maripa, unawareness. But it's known colloquially when the object that you're ignorant about is the I. It's called ego grasping or self grasping. So this is the really powerful one. That's the root of them. So the two main voices of that, the next one is called attachment. This cute word. Lama Yeshe says, I could tell you about attachment for one whole year. You will never begin to understand it until you start to really work deeply inside. So we have to learn the theory first. Like anything, you have to learn the recipe first. Then you have to do the work, you know. So what is attachment? And then the third one is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. So the two, the essential one here that is effectively the main cause of suffering in daily life, and this is according to the Buddha, even though ego grasping is the root delusion, effectively the main cause of suffering in daily life is called attachment. And this is a total surprise because, of course, the definition we have of attachment is absolutely nothing to do with what Buddha is saying. And this is why I can't stress enough. When you hear the Buddhist word attachment, you have to stop using your definition. We all know you can have same word, different definitions, but we don't get confused. You know, like in England and in Australia, we used to live in a flat Now, because we're also Americanized, we live in apartments, okay? Because we all watched American television when we were little girls. So we used to live in a flat. It was just what we called it, a flat. Don't know why. It's called a flat. So if I only knew the word flat as referring to a little house, then when I hear that a table is flat, I've never heard this before, I'll get very confused. I'll go, oh, you mean I've got to live there? Because I don't know the other definition. So it's not that complicated. We know there are several definitions of flat. If you play music, you have to play a thing in B flat. So it's the same word, same spelling, same pronunciation. So we're not surprised by words having different definitions. But as soon as we hear attachment, we get stuck on our definition. And we conflate that word with love and closeness with our friends. She's very attached to her family. And that's a perfectly reasonable way to put it, but that's the way we say it in the West. That's not the way Buddha uses the word attachment. So because he makes this utter distinction, and this is the part that is very, very hard to get our heads around, I tell you. To see the distinction, for example, between the state of mind called attachment for my beloved boyfriend and love for my beloved boyfriend. We conflate those. Even as Buddhists, we conflate them. And we can be forgiven for doing that because you see, right now, our mind is full of all these different states of mind, all these emotions, like a big soup. We can't distinguish one from another because we've never practiced that view, but that's the view we have to do in Buddhism. The key job of being a Buddhist, the essential job, is distinguishing between the neurotic states of mind and the virtuous states of mind. And there's a very logical reason. Let's look at this word Buddha, which is the end result of this entire path, okay? The word Buddha, the etymology of this word is very delicious, and the Tibetan equivalent, Sangye, same. Sang or Bud implies the utter eradication from our mind of all delusion, all neuroses, all ego grasping, all attachment, all anger, all jealousy, all pride, etc. And even this alone is so shocking, we can't even hear it. We just can't hear it. Because there's nothing equivalent in modern psychology. There's no equivalent in neuroscientists. You go to a neuroscientist and you say, can you please give me methods to get rid of all anger, all attachment, all jealousy? He'll think you're mentally ill. That means you've got to cut out a piece of your brain. He'll tell you, we tried that in the 1930s and it was called a lobotomy and it didn't work. So there's no view, and there's no view in our psychology or no view in our psychotherapy. And they're not being insulting. It's just a different view. It's a shocking concept. In fact, we so totally take for granted that attachment and anger and jealousy and pride and low self-esteem are natural parts of a normal person that we think you'd be insane if you didn't have them. I mean, this is the point. And so that's why it's hard for us to hear this view of the Buddhas indicated by the etymology of this first syllable, that the goal, finally, everything in this path that we're talking about is leading us to the eradication from our mind of all delusions. This is too bizarre for words. This is what Buddha means by getting rid of suffering and its causes. Because there's the root cause of all suffering, period, since beginningless time, is these delusions in the minds of sentient beings that cause us to do things with our body and speech that perpetuate this suffering. This is the Buddha's analysis. So no one revealed this to him. This is the job he's done himself. That's the first syllable. What about the second one? Da, ye. They imply the development to perfection of everything else in our mind. Love, compassion, wisdom, kindness. I mean, how, and we can develop those to perfection. This is the fundamental point that underpins all Buddhist views, all Buddhist psychology, all Buddhist practice. This finding that those states of mind, the neurotic ones, are adventitious, are not intrinsic, are not integral to our being, and therefore can be utterly eradicated. I mean, this is such a different view that it's almost impossible to hear it. And the second one is that the other states of mind, they are intrinsic to us. They are at the core of our being. They are impossible to be removed. Why? It's because the first lot are out of sync with reality. And the second lot are in sync with reality. This is very hard to see because this is not the way we think about the mind in modern psychology or neuroscience. So, and this is the trouble. The words are the same. Love and anger and compassion and kindness. Everybody on the planet uses them. But this is Buddha's analysis of them. And if you want to be a Buddhist, if you don't study this and understand what Buddha's talking about, how can you say you're a Buddhist? It's demented. We can go for another 30 minutes if you want, Donna. Or is it too much for people to have you waiting around for half an hour? Lorna's saying no, it's enough. I mean, maybe because I shout and talk so fast. It must be exhausting. Maybe an hour's enough. An hour and a half.
I actually have another class at 6.
Oh, darling, there you go. So you need to get off. That's true. A good point, Lorna. Anyway, maybe we don't have to go further. I'm just feeling bad because I cheated you over half an hour. I'm sorry.
We do have a couple.
What, darling?
There are a couple of questions in chat now.
Good. Okay. So why, and Lorna, you go if you have to go, darling. Don't hesitate. So let's just have some questions. So what I've done is a summary. Okay. I've summarized. I'm taking the lamb rim as the packaging. I'm touching upon the essential part of the first scope, which is karma. I'm touching upon the essential part of the second one, which is the mind, and trying to see the explicit teaching of why they fit at those places, control the body, speech, and mind, but looking at the implicit teaching, which is the way karma works, which how it helps you become less neurotic, therefore less ego grasping, and the way that by understanding the way the mind works, how that can also help us loosen the grip of ego grasping as well. How these are leading us to understand emptiness. That's what I'm trying to get at. That's the essence. So please ask me questions. I'm more than happy.
Okay, the first one is, how do you determine the difference between delusion and a previous experience? Or doesn't it matter if either one causes suffering?
I don't understand the difference between a previous experience. I don't get that point. I would love to know what that person means. Who is it? Would they like to talk to me? I don't understand that difference.
Hi, Venerable Rabina.
Where are you?
It's Laura. I'm right here.
Good, Laura. Talk to me. What do you mean exactly, darling?
Actually, it's my husband's question. He snuck in. He has the question.
Okay, please ask me. Hello.
The question is, earlier on in the talk,
you've got to get a bit closer, darling. I just can't hear you. Well, I'm so sorry.
Earlier in your discussion, you said that Buddha had two main causes of suffering, which karma, previous experiences, and delusion.
Okay, previous action.
Previous action. I'm sorry.
Yeah. We're just using this as a simple analogy because he's talking about past lives. But like, you know, there's two things. Why today, you know, I've got no cake in the fridge. One is because of the past action 3 days ago of eating up all the cake. And two, driven by my greed and my lack of compassion for you. So there's two things. The past action I did that was driven by the delusion that now is ripening as me having no cake in the fridge. So the distinction is you've got to just, so there's no real concept then of distinguishing between a past experience. It's learning to know, one, an action we do with body and speech, every action we do with body and speech is driven by some part of our mind. So those that are neurotic, that sow seeds in my mind that'll cause me future suffering, will be actions driven by attachment or anger or something. And a positive action will be an action driven by compassion or kindness or goodness. So it's karma is action that I did in the past, and then second is delusion that drove that action that then is making that seed now come to fruit as an experience of suffering, or if it's a happy one, an experience of happiness.
Okay, thank you.
That's analysis. Thank you so much. Okay, good. What else, people?
Okay, the second question is, how should I process my interaction with someone who may be stuck in an ego-grasping frame of mind?
Well, I don't quite know exactly the point you're making, but I can hear something. But let me put it this way. The only way I can learn to navigate another person in my relationship with them is by understanding their mind. And the only way I can understand their mind is by understanding my own mind. So if you're my boyfriend or my girlfriend, whoever, and you've got lots of anger, it's very obvious. If you've got lots of anger, let's say, and if I haven't begun to take responsibility for my anger, even if it's not as much as yours, if I don't already understand my aversion, if I don't understand that my anger is a response to my attachment not getting what it wants, if I haven't done that inner work and understood anger, I cannot possibly deal with yours. I will just bump into yours with my anger and we're going to have a fight. So the only thing that, the main thing that qualifies me to help me navigate my relationship with you is my knowledge of my mind. Because, honey, we're all, what is it, cut from the same cloth. We're just different shapes, you know. So the only, that's the, and that's the same with if you're my child. You know, many mummies come to me and say, what am I going to do with my 15-year-old daughter? She throws chairs at me, you know. Well, first of all, if you haven't dealt with your anger and your fears, you cannot deal with your daughter's anger and fears. This is so logical somehow. In other words, it's just a simple thing like saying, if you're, you know, overweight and obese and, no, even forget that, if you're unhealthy because you haven't eaten good food, if I don't know nutrition, how the hell can I help you? I don't know how to analyze your problem because I don't even know about my own problem. But if I know good nutrition and I know what causes me to be healthy and unhealthy, then I can advise you. This is fundamental, and that's the wisdom wing. There's the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. Compassion wing is how to help others. But as Dalai Lama says, compassion is not enough, folks. You've got to have wisdom. And wisdom comes from working on your own mind, abiding by the laws of karma, knowing your own mind, being your own therapist, unpacking and unraveling your own rubbish. Because we've all got the same rubbish. It's just a question of degree. That's all. That's the answer. Who else? Donna. Maybe that's enough then.
Nothing else in chat right now?
Okay. Nobody has any points then. We've covered masses of stuff, of course. That'll do then, maybe, folks. Robert, got any questions? Robert, there's Robert. Okay. Nobody got any questions? Linda, Giovanna, Tupton Chuying. Karen. Hello, Karen. Happy to see you, darling. Almost see you're in the dark, but I can see you vaguely. I can see the indication of your presence.
Yes, the indication of my presence. I'm sitting outside.
Oh, good. Jill Marie. Hello, sweetheart. Happy to see you, darling. Deborah. Paula. Who else? Come on. So maybe that's enough then. Maybe we'll go now. What do you think? I have to make up my other time. I'm so sorry about missing. I mean, I had it in my calendar. I'm usually very good at this, and then I just somehow forgot. So, darlings, we're finished.
All okay.
So think about what I've said. Try and remember. Think about all the teachings. Read the course notes, maybe. But the point I'm trying to get to, as I'm saying, you know, there's the explicit teaching about the essence of the first scope, which is karma. Be a nice person. But the implicit one is once you practice karma, it loosens the grip of ego grasp because you start becoming more accountable, which is more grown up, which is the opposite to innocent victim. And then when you get to the mind and unpack and unravel the delusions, you start to see how they are leading you up a garden path. They're misconceptions. And we're going to go into that in more depth next week. Okay, darling people, so we just dedicate. This first little prayer is just saying, really, and I'll put it in English, just simple words, that all these, I mean, this 90 minutes, more than that, that we've been together, like I said before, not a millisecond goes astray. Every millisecond of our time together has sown seeds in the mind. So we think how marvelous, let's nourish these seeds, you know, so that we can become the Buddha as we motivated in the beginning, so we can be a benefit to others. Long-term goal. And the second one, may this supreme and marvelous aspiration called bodhicitta, which we'll talk about, may it, where it hasn't arisen in the minds of others, may it arise and grow. And may where it has arisen, may it not diminish, but grow and grow. And we can sing together in Tibetan if you like. Gewa Lama Sange Drugyone Drowa Chikyang Malupa Dei Sala Gupa Shok Jangchub semchogrin poche, ma ke panam ke gyochig, ke panyam pa me payang, gong ne gong du pelvasho. Thank you, Donna. I'm so sorry again, you people. I'll promise I'll be there on time. So maybe Donna's got to send me a message 10 minutes before. Text me, Donna. I'll give you my phone number. You can text me.
Thank you so much, Venerable.
Thank you, darling people, all of you. So happy to see you all. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Much love, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, thank you so much for helping us.